Good morning. Welcome to Garden Life, a KRFY morning show. This is Julie Puchinski, your Garden Life host, here with my favorite co-host, Julie Calamine.
Yes, good morning, Julie. And as I say just about every time, I am your only host, co-host.
Still favorite.
There you go.
So this is a pre-recorded show. We're recording early and going to broadcast it on our usual first Tuesday of the month. And it's a show about spring tree care and soil health. So as the days lengthen and sunlight strengthens, our thoughts turn to spring. And our first job in the garden is tree care and soil health. So on the show is our local fruit tree expert, Kyle Nagy, superintendent and orchard operations manager of the U of I Organic Agriculture Center. And for soil health, we have a new guest, Kendall Call, assistant professor and extension specialist, also at the U of I. Kyle has been a frequent guest here. And Kyle, take a minute and remind people of what's involved with managing the Ag Center. And also, thank you for coming in today. I should start with that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Happy to be back. Yeah, so we're out at the University of Idaho Sandpoint Organic Agriculture Center. We're right down by the base of Schweitzer. We have our big orchard out there. We have around 650 trees in the ground, and we specialize in heritage and antique varieties. So we have about 68 different types of apples out there right now, along with our pears and our cherries and some plums and a lone apricot as well. So we're always thinking about our trees this time of year, for sure.
For sure.
One lonely apricot. But the 68 fruit trees are amazing because when you have your fall apple tasting, we have the opportunity as residents of Sandpoint to taste a lot of those. And I've tasted a bunch of them, Kyle, and it's so much fun. I know it's not our topic for this morning, but every time you tell me about those 68 varieties, I just think, oh, so many interesting, fun. They're not exactly, we don't call them heirloom. You call them
heritage varieties.
Yes. Not always for eating. Juicers, some.
Exactly. There's some apples out there that you wouldn't want to take a bite out of.
More of an apple jack apple.
There you go.
And also we have Kendall on, and this is Kendall's first time, as I mentioned. Kendall, introduce yourself and your position with this extension service.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Happy to be here.
So I am an extension specialist with the university, and my subject area is organic and sustainable agriculture. And so this is a new position and a new program within extension that was built to support farmers and ranchers who are interested in integrating organic management practices. And so my job is to support their efforts through research or helping to connect them with other resources.
And are you stationed out at the SOAC out there?
I am, yep.
What a perfect place, because it's an organic orchard and this is the organic push.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm hoping to do is to just integrate some more research into that farm, in addition to all the wonderful programs that Kyle has built over the years.
Great. Yeah, we've mostly just been having fun for the last few years. Now we have somebody that can actually put numbers to all the work we've been doing.
Right, document it, yes, and make it make sense.
Yeah, hopefully it still stays fun.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And this is going to be a round robin talk, so everyone jump in on every topic.
Yes, and I was just going to say how great to have you here, as Julie already said, in conjunction with the organic facility, but there seem to be so many organic gardeners up here in the panhandle that are going to benefit from your research and getting to know you all there.
Yeah, certainly, I hope so.
Yes.
Great. So we'll start with what's on everybody's mind, tree pruning, and especially fruit trees. So Kyle, you can begin. What's the purpose of pruning?
So we want to give our trees a really good good lease on life. We want them to have a good start to their season, and pruning is always a good way to start that. We prune for a number of different reasons, from pest and disease control to structure of the tree. There's all kinds of different training methods that go along with the pruning, depending on your specific goals as you go. So you really want to have a plan when you're going into your pruning, but I like to say that pruning can be some of the best fertilizer, because you can really direct that growth, into areas of the tree that you want it and prevent growth in other areas. So it can really do a lot for you.
So it's very diverse depending on what kind of trees and shrubs, because all trees and shrubs would benefit from pruning, wouldn't you say?
For sure, yeah. Yeah, definitely. The form that you're pruning them into is going to dictate a lot about how productive they are or where their blooms are, depending on the species that you're working with. So yeah, it can have a lot of effects on your season for you.
And natives, will you be pruning? Do you usually prune natives as well?
Yeah, we have our native plant garden out at SOAC, and we'll do some pruning in there as well. Mostly those are just used as a demonstration to show people what our native plants can contribute to a thriving landscape. So we'll do some maintenance pruning in there as well.
In general, do native plants need pruning, or is this more of an optional pruning?
It's going to depend a lot on where they are in their life cycle. We especially when they're younger, we like to do some pruning so that we're getting good structure so that it's going to be a prominent figure in your landscape. But as a lot of trees or native plants get older, they don't require as much of that pruning regime, yeah.
Once you get the shape you want.
Yeah, yep, yeah. With the fruit trees, though, it's an every year kind of thing. You got to stay on top of those guys.
Yeah, so moving to fruit trees, first of all, explain the different cuts, the heading cut versus the thinning cuts.
Yeah, so in fruit trees, we're mostly thinking about thinning cuts. So a thinning cut is a cut made back to a strong node or a strong bud or a branch leaving. That can absorb all that energy that's coming towards that that bud or that area, where a heading cut is a cut made back to a weaker node that isn't able to absorb all that energy that's coming towards it. So then you're going to get more side branching in going on there, where a thinning cut, you're more of directing all that energy to one direction that you want it to go. That heading cut is to give you a spur of growth in different directions.
That gives a good visual to the difference between heading and thinning. And thinning is the one you'll use most often.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the time we're going to do thinning cuts because we don't, a lot of the time in fruit trees, we don't want that flurry of growth coming up. So we'll usually be doing thinning cuts. But with heading cuts, we'll use those if we're trying to force side branching on some of our main branches. That those heading cuts can be useful there.
And then as I try to visualize what you're talking about, the thinning cuts is sort of opening up the tree. It's you're getting more space between where the branches are. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and then the heading ones are sort of like if you're looking at a, let's not use a tree as an example, but a shrub, the kinds that you just nip along the outside edges and they turn into balls.
Yeah, yep,
yes. Yes, okay.
And our main goal for our fruit tree pruning is we want to create a canopy that's nice and open and airy. We want the sunlight to be able to penetrate that canopy and touch all that fruit because we need that sunlight on the fruit for ripening. And then it's also to dry out that canopy as quickly as possible. So we have that morning dew or an overnight rain or anything. We want all of our leaf surfaces to dry off as quickly as possible because that's going to really cut back on the amount of bacterial and fungal diseases that we're dealing with. Because the longer your leaf surfaces are wet, the more of a chance they have to really take hold.
So you're not, when you're heading back, you're not really going to where the fruit buds are, or are you?
No, with a heading cut, you're usually going to either a vegetative bud, a leaf bud, or just a weaker place on that branch that's not going to be able to absorb all that energy, and it's going to force it outward.
So are you actually trimming for more fruit, too, as well as the airflow?
So we'll do some. In most of the time, there's on apple trees especially, you're having fruit spurs, new growth every year. But if we have some that, especially on older trees that aren't regenerating their fruit spurs, then we'll have to do some different cuts to try and force some growth in areas that are going to produce those fruit spurs.
Okay. Knowing the tree, really.
Yeah, yep. And it's usually more of an issue with an older tree that you're trying to reinvigorate versus a younger tree. They're kind of doing their own thing at that point.
Yeah, you're kind of schooling the younger trees to grow the way you want them to from the beginning.
Yeah,
if you're paying attention.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why you got to be on it every year,
yes,
for sure.
Yes. How much should you cut off a tree? Is there a rule of thumb?
So rule of thumb is usually around a third or so, but I try to go less than that whenever possible. I try to keep it under a quarter. And the reason for that is because your whole root system is still there. So it's going to be sending all that energy up to that entire canopy that it thinks is still there. And if you're cutting off more than a third, it's going to have a lot of spots where that energy just doesn't have anywhere to go. And that's where you get all those water sprouts, the guys that are just going straight up towards the sky.
Sure.
And we consider those energy sinks because that's all they're going to do is take energy away from where you want it to go in the tree. So yeah, it's good to not cut off too much and you're just going to force more cuts in the future.
But do you have the those straight up sucker, those shoots that go straight up every year on every tree? It seems like in my yard, I have some no matter what on fruit trees.
Yeah. So fruit trees, it's pretty typical. And a lot of the time those water sprouts are going to originate from around your pruning wounds. And what we're doing is we do two prunings throughout the year. So we'll do our dormant season pruning this first half of March, and then we'll do our summer pruning in the first half of August. And this dormant season pruning is where we're really trying to form the structure of the tree. And in our summer pruning, that's when we're going through and we're getting rid of all those water sprouts and the suckers that have come up in that growing season. And that just makes it so that when we're doing our dormant season pruning this time of year, we're really looking at the form of the tree and not all that scattered stuff in the background that you're just going to have to get rid of.
So the summer pruning, and I'm trying not to jump ahead on topics, but does the summer pruning, is there a chance that that is a more susceptible time for the tree to be pruned? Are there insect or bacterial problems when you prune that time of the year?
That time of the year, I'm not too concerned about bacterial and fungal infections just because it's a much drier time of year. And that's one of the reasons that this time of year when we're doing our dormant season pruning, for the most part, we're only pruning our apples and pear trees. And then we'll leave most of our stone fruit pruning for summer. So like our cherry trees, we're not pruning our cherry trees until right after our cherry harvest. And the reason for that is our stone fruits tend to be a lot more susceptible to bacterial and fungal infections. And in North Idaho, we're in an area that we're likely to get some moisture during this dormant season pruning. And we just don't want to be opening up any of those wounds on our stone fruits unnecessarily.
And so does that make Idaho a little different than, for example, maybe a Midwestern or a Southern climate where it seems like they're always recommending pruning in the winter and not pruning when it's humid, hot and humid in the summer. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's going to be very regionally dependent. We're so dry up here that usually during those summer, when we're doing that summer pruning, we're very low humidity and we don't have a whole lot of moisture events during that summer. But I am, during that summer pruning, I'm looking out for the next week and making sure that we have a dry window, which doesn't seem like it's too hard to find that window during the summer up here.
And to speak to that winter pruning, you'd like people to wait until March to prune. You don't care for winter pruning up here.
Yeah.
Explain that to us.
So one of the reasons that we prune late or later than a lot of people would think is because we have winters like we did a few years ago when we hit negative 22 degrees in the orchard. And if we would have pruned in December and then had that negative 22, we could have tip dieback where those from where we made our cuts in December, we have tissue death out at that cut, and then we end up having to trim back further than we initially thought just to get rid of that dead tissue. Another reason that we prune a little bit later is because I've read some studies that talked about how by pruning later, you can force your flowering a little bit later. And in North Idaho, we're always concerned about frost in the middle of our bloom. So just by pushing that pruning off a little later, we might be gaining ourselves an extra few days before our flowers open, and maybe those extra few days is all it takes to get past that last hard frost for us.
For sure, and you've experienced some years where you've had the late frost and the resulting low yields.
For sure, yeah. I think it was 2021, we had a morning where we hit 27 degrees for 3 hours, and right in the middle of our bloom, and that was enough time to take our harvest down by 80% that year.
Oh, gosh.
So,
and
yeah.
You're in that cold pocket there, too.
Yeah, we do get that some of those cold, wet winds coming down off the mountains and everything here.
Okay, so I have a couple more questions on pruning that always come up for me. Why is it important to have a single leader?
So we recommend the single leader training for our apple and pear trees. But for our stone fruits, we're usually doing like an open vase shape. I really like the central leader structure for apples, especially on a semi-dwarfing rootstock. Mm-hmm. It's going to create some of the strongest branch unions that you can have. And we're asking these, our scaffolding branches to hold a lot of weight. So we want to make sure we have strong unions there. With the stone fruit, they don't put on as much fruit weight as the apples and pears do. So we're not as concerned about breaking branches. So by having that open vase shape, we're creating a lot of square footage for these, or a lot of area for the flowers and fruit to produce on those stone fruit. And we're not as concerned about that fruit weight causing breakage.
I see some of my trees that I've had for a lot of years that I wasn't paying attention to that center leader, and they aren't fruit trees, but they've made that top weak. Like if the wind comes in, it snaps off that because of the, what is it? It's got to be 30% for a scaffolding branch.
So our scaffolding branches, we're looking to be about 45 to 60 degrees off of vertical.
Okay.
And that creates a nice strong branch union for us. But yeah, and there are a lot of our deciduous trees, the maples tend to do kind of a modified central leader where they'll come up as a single trunk, put off a few main branches, and then as they get higher, they split into kind of a multi-topped tree. And that can work in fruit trees as well. But it does create some weaker joints up high, and especially if you're in a windy area,
yes,
it creates more of a sail higher up in the tree, which can contribute to that breaking of branches and stuff.
Yes, yeah, so structure is important on
Definitely.
Those fruit trees that have to carry a heavy load every summer or every other summer. Makes sense.
And then do you paint your cuts, or what do you do as far as that?
So it used to be common practice to paint over your pruning wounds with like a tar or something like that. But newer research has shown that that's not really very effective. So we're actually advising against that. What they found is that tar paint could sometimes seal in bacteria and fungal inoculum that could contribute to infection later on. So best practice is to make a nice clean cut. And on an angle, you don't want to have a flat cut that water is going to sit on and soak down in. So you want a cut that's going to shed water and then just let it dry out and do its thing.
Okay.
Trees have been doing this for a billion years, so mm-hmm. they know how to do it.
Right, right. And speak to sun scald in the summer that you use to protect the trunks of your trees.
Yeah, so mostly we're concerned about the sun scald through the winter, even though we don't get a whole lot of sunny days in the winter. But we put white tree wraps around the trunks of our trees. And the idea behind that is we have the sun reflecting off of the white snow and up onto the dark trunk of the tree. And when we have that happen through the whole winter, that trunk is expanding and contracting a very small amount every day. And what you can end up with is a crack along
yes.
the south side of your tree.
Mm-hmm.
And cracks are notoriously slow to heal over. So if we can avoid that, we really want to. So by putting a white tree wrap around the trunk of the tree, we're not absorbing that heat into the dark tissue of the trunk. So we're not getting that expansion and contraction, and we can avoid that crack.
Yeah, I've experienced that. And it's kind of a bummer when that happens to your tree because it really is not a good situation. The other thing that happens down at the base of those trees are all the little critters that are running around. Mm-hmm. Talk about how you're trying to control them.
For sure, yeah. So with the critters, mostly what we're talking about are the voles, those guys that leave those beautiful trails across your lawn every spring. Those guys, they're cruising that snow soil line all winter looking for some tender tissue to eat. And if they find a young fruit tree, that's going to be some of the most tender bark out there for them. So they'll girdle their way around that trunk, and if they make it all the way around, they can cut off all that conductive tissue mm-hmm. and can cause tree death eventually. So what we're doing is we use a hardware cloth. It's that fine galvanized mesh, and we put that around the trunk of the tree down to the root flare up about 24 inches or so. We go through in the fall and we tighten that tight to the trunk of the tree so they can't get up behind it. And then in the spring, when we're not as concerned about them, we'll loosen that up so we're not restricting growth. But that can help a lot for the rodent pressure, for sure.
And your pea gravel mulch as well.
Yeah, yep, we use a pea gravel mulch around the base of the trees. That helps with annual weeds. They're mm-hmm. easy to pull out there. It also prevents having competition with your young trees right up against it. But for the voles, it prevents them from creating a super highway right to the trunk of that tree, because that pea gravel kind of will cave in on them mm-hmm. Rather than have allowing them to build a tunnel right into there. So, yeah.
Tell us how large of a diameter of pea gravel and how deep do you like it to be?
We're usually going about 3 foot diameter and just about 3 inches deep or so. And okay. that seems to make quite a difference for them.
3 inches deep. That's not too tough.
No. Yeah. Yep. And we don't want that pea gravel right up against the trunk of the tree because it can hold moisture and cause rotting
right,
issues.
Right.
So we like to have that spread out away from the trunk just a little bit.
And that hasn't always been how people have mulched around their fruit trees, has it?
No. And there's a number of different ways. And we've tried a bunch of different things as well. And we found that the pea gravel worked best for us. We've done some bark mulches before, and it seemed like that just increased our rodent pressure,
right.
Which caused us some heartache for sure. So as soon as we discovered that, we got rid of that bark mulch that we were trying.
We can turn to Kendall now, and this is a lot of information in your organic information that you're gathering from Kyle, but let's talk about soil health. Let's pivot to that, shall we? Unless there's anything else about the tree trimming. Or Julie?
Well, this is not where you're mainly working, Kyle, but there's so many other little shrubs and trees and things that we're getting to this time of the year. And do you recommend a March pruning for all plants or just the fruiting trees?
I'd prioritize your fruit trees. But then beyond that, I would think about some of your other deciduous trees and then maybe start to think about your shrubs. Usually shrubs are being done a little bit later. Sometimes that can help identify where you have live tissue and dead tissue.
Yes, for sure.
But yeah, I'd recommend getting on your fruit trees early.
Get there in March and then worry about the other ones a little later.
Yeah.
And we've spoken of this before, but your berries, those you've also pushed ahead. You don't prune them out in the fall. You wait a while to take them down in the spring.
Yep. And you can do it either way. And we've been so busy in the fall a lot of the time, mm-hmm. we don't get to them. But also, those spent raspberry canes especially, they have a lot of carbohydrates that are still inside those spent stems. And over the winter, they're actually sending those carbohydrates back down into the root system, which can help invigorate your next season's growth. But if you only have time in the fall to do it, then do it in the fall.
But it's nice to know that you're actually helping your raspberry or blackberry plant by pushing that off till spring.
For sure. Yeah.
So
definitely.
We don't have to feel too stressed in the fall if we don't get to that.
Right. And cutting less is better in the fall anyway, because you got all that habitat, pollinator habitat that you're cutting down and taking their homes away.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
Okay, to soils. Oh, I'm so excited. Okay, Kendall, I looked up your bio, and it had so many interesting things in it. So first of all, I know Kyle did his thesis on regenerative agriculture, but can you describe to us what that is?
Sure, yeah. Regenerative agricultural means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And I guess the way I think about it is practices that regenerate our soil. So things that are going to help put more organic matter back in there, maybe bring in more plant diversity, support the soil ecosystems. Sometimes people think of this as being sort of beyond organic, sort of within what we think of as certified organic production mm-hmm. or management. And to others, it's, you know, just reducing inputs potentially in a non-organic system. So, and then integrating some of these other practices that help support the soil. So in that sense, I think it's great for our soils in general. It's moving all sort of management towards a sort of healthier, more supportive management.
Right. Soil health. Mm-hmm. I had talked to a couple of market gardeners last year, and one gal fertilizes every week. Every week she fertilizes something. And one of the other growers, she said she spent 3 or 4 years just doing soil tests until she figured out exactly what she needed to have in the soil, and she never had to do supplemental fertilizing after that. And I thought, wow, that's probably more of the regenerative type of agriculture, because you're putting it all back in the soil somehow.
Yeah, and I mean, I think both of those sort of strategies can work where you're kind of doing a sort of big intervention that sort of sends your ecosystem in the direction you want it to go versus mm-hmm. sometimes there's intermediary things you can do to help it along the way.
So first of all, describe the soil ecosystem.
Yeah, so it's that whole habitat of organisms that live below ground, right? So it's diverse microorganisms, including bacteria and fungi, and some of the larger organisms, like our earthworms or other arthropods, sometimes our voles, like mm-hmm. we were just talking about, mm-hmm. But also the plants that are growing in the soil, kind of all working together and supporting each other through exchange of nutrients. And then it's also this sort of amazing physical environment that's created by these small mineral particles, right? These crushed rocks that break down over geologic time periods that allow for this exchange of air and water and nutrients that supports this whole host of organisms.
Is that considered like the biological till? Or what's that?
Yeah, so biological till is sort of a term we'd use for when you might plant certain species to help break up the soil. So you'd plant plants that have large roots or sort of something like a large taproot, like a turnip or
mustards.
Radish. Yeah, or mm-hmm. mustard, or sometimes even a grass species that just has a very sort of extensive fibrous rooting system that just helps, break up that soil.
Okay. So is no-till, has it been proven to be a better technique for growing? I mean, is the science behind it?
Yeah, it's a little nuanced, right? There's no sort of one-size-fits-all to any farming system. No-till can be a really great strategy. The less we sort of disturb the soil ecosystem, the more it can sort of thrive mm-hmm. on its own. Mm-hmm. But soils are also very resilient, and so sometimes tillage can be a useful tool. It really can depend on the type of soil and the type of farming and the landscape.
Okay.
And would soils that are easily compacted benefit from a little more till or not necessarily?
Yeah, again, and that can be a hard one. So you can create compaction by tilling too much and kind of continuously break down some of that natural structure that roots and these other organisms will create. But sometimes tillage can help get plants established, right? If it's too compacted to even get roots down in there, you need to come in. Sometimes coming in to break that up will help the plant get established, and then you can sort of try to cultivate that structure from there.
Now, you're gardening, Kyle, at the center. Is it no-till, or do you guys till it before you plant your vegetable gardens?
So the vegetable garden, our educational market garden, that has been no-till for a number of years now.
Mm-hmm.
But there are cases where we do some tillage. One example of that would be this past year we put in a large plot of potatoes for the Bonner Community Food Bank, which was a great collaboration. But one of our issues is that we have quackgrass like crazy.
Yes.
And if anybody deals with quackgrass, they know how much of a pain it can be. And we didn't want to have to deal with that competition in our potato bed. So we used it's a technique from, I believe it's the University of Maine, and it's an organic method for controlling quackgrass. And what that is it's a heavy tillage regime. So for the first year or first summer or so, what we're doing is we till, and then when that quackgrass starts coming up, it doesn't start spreading by rhizome until it puts up its third leaf.
Mm.
So every time we would see that third leaf come up, we'd go back through and till it again. And the idea behind that is if it can't spread by rhizomes, we're chopping that rhizome up and it keeps trying to send up those leaves. It's expending all of its energy that it has. And then if we do that over and over, by the time we're hitting our frost dates in fall, it can't survive that frost. So we've done that pretty successfully to eradicate quackgrass from an area. But it is a heavy tillage regime to get it started. But then once we're at that point where the quackgrass is out, then we can stop tilling in there for a while until, of course, the quack grass begins to spread by rhizome from the edges back in. But that's been a really effective method for us. But it does involve destroying some of that soil structure.
Right.
But the idea is once we're past that stage, then we can start concentrating on our soil health again.
That's what I had heard about no-till, is it's the weed problem that a lot of times will you'll have to till just to control the weeds a little bit. But that's interesting. I'm curious how that's going to work this year. So you should have them pretty much cleared out the beginning of the year and have a minor.
Hopefully we won't be dealing with a whole lot of quack grass out there this year.
That's great.
Just wore that stuff down. Wore it down.
Yep.
That's good.
Also in Kendall's bio, you have earthworm ecology. What's that?
Yeah, so previous to this position, I have been doing research with the U of I for the last decade, and we did a lot of work with earthworms, trying to understand how different farming practices affected them. So earthworm ecology is really like the study of how earthworms behave and interact in that habitat. We tend to classify them into sort of the surface dwellers, sort of the medium soil depth dwellers, and our deep soil dwellers. And often we refer to them as our ecosystem engineers because they affect other organisms, they affect the chemistry, and there are chemical processes that are happening in the soil, and they affect the physical environment. So because they're one of our larger soil organisms, they can really have a significant impact.
Yes.
And do we consider earthworms really good or what? Because they're not native to North America, correct?
Correct. Yeah, I often say that they're one of the few good invasive species. In most instances, there's very few cases where they can sort of create too much, or they can allow water to infiltrate too quickly through a soil profile that can cause issues with groundwater contamination. But in very few instances, is that a problem, and it doesn't tend to be a problem in our ecosystems here.
So to encourage them in your soil, what kind of practices would you do?
Right. So reducing your tillage is a great way to help earthworms, but they are resilient. They reproduce rapidly, and as long as there's enough food in there for them and you've sort of created a good habitat otherwise for them, they can kind of rebound from some amount of tillage. But having a lot of organic matter, whether that's through compost or just plants growing in that soil, can help support them. Keeping the soil covered so that it stays moist and not that hot just helps create an environment that's conducive to them being active. And yeah, just thinking about the trees kind of come into life and budding out, this is also when our soil wakes up. And as the temperatures start to increase, microbes become more active, the earthworms become more active. You can actually start to see them. There are certain types of worms that create these little mounds at the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you know what you're looking for, you can see them start creating these little mounds out in your lawn and in your garden.
That's when the robins come.
Right.
That's right.
Earthworms ecology, so many things deep in the soil, but sometimes we do need to add amendments. Talk to us about soil amendments, dry versus wet, and what you think is a good practice. And Kyle, come in too as well as and tell us what you do in your regime at the gardens.
Right. So often we add amendments to either add carbon or nutrients specifically, and sometimes both. So some of our higher carbon amendments we would apply are something like a compost or another organic fertilizer that's just got other organic material in it.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, these organic forms of nutrients are going to be what we think of as our slow release type nutrients because the plants can't take up the organic forms. So they're going to rely on those soil organisms to convert the nutrients to forms that can be taken up by plants.
And what are some examples of those inputs that we're using for carbon enhancement? We probably know a lot of them, but let's just run through a few.
Right. So various types of compost, that if it's like the classic example, or things like soil builders, products that you can buy at the hardware store. Is that the type of product you're thinking of?
Peat moss, or are they your leaves from your trees? Are they, does manure count as a compost?
Sure, yeah.
Those sorts of things.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. I guess I often think, in general, it's better to apply a composted manure. So I still kind of put that in my mind as a
compost. As a compost, sure.
Just where it's at least or aged, and you've allowed some of that those nutrients to start to decompose a little bit before your before you apply it to your garden. Mm-hmm. And then there's also plenty of products that you can buy that are these more readily available, plant available forms of nutrients, like nitrogen, phosphorus, mm-hmm. potassium, mm-hmm. various compositions of those nutrients. And that would be a fertilizer that you would apply maybe more frequently, kind of like that just situation you were describing mm-hmm. earlier. Mm-hmm. Where you'd maybe apply smaller amounts and more frequently because it's just going to be available versus something like a compost or a manure that you would apply ahead of time, maybe in a larger quantity, and over time those nutrients would convert, mineralize mm-hmm. To forms that the plants could take them
right,
on.
Become available.
And for folks who are thinking, what might I have around my house to minimize external inputs? It is things like what, leaves or bark? Can you use shredded wood? Of course, that takes a while to break down. What are some examples homeowners might have around that they could use?
Yeah, I mean, you can make compost, certainly, using a lot of your yard scraps mixed with food scraps mm-hmm. is a great way, right?
Grass trimmings, grass all trimmings, that stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
Grass trimmings, leaves. And in general, if you're adding something like a more of a high carbon, like woody material, that's better applied as a mulch on top and will slowly decompose and be brought into the soil by organisms. But yeah, better used it more as a mulch on top.
Mm-hmm. Slow to decompose.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Do you do a soil test? I mean, how do you decide what you need to add to your soil?
Yeah, a soil test is a great, a great tool to help you determine if you need to add fertilizers. So you can get a basic soil test that'll tell you your organic matter content, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and soil pH. And that can be a great way to just kind of understand some general properties of your soil. And if you need to add more, sometimes you may not need to.
Mm-hmm.
In general, though, in any type of crop production where we're harvesting parts of plants and removing it, we're removing nutrients from that soil. So over time, we do need to replenish that in some way. There's a variety of different ways to do that.
Mm-hmm. We could move into cover crops. I think that is...
I was just going to mention, in the orchard, what we're using mostly is a composted chicken manure, and that has been a good general fertilizer for us. And we're doing a soil test usually every 2 to 3 years just to see that we're on the right track and we're not severely deficient anywhere. And that seems to keep us pretty well on track.
Yeah, and I guess just to build on that, I think, you know, in a home garden, I don't think testing a soil every year is necessary, but sometimes is a great tool to either diagnose a problem or just with a new garden to know kind of what you're dealing with.
Yes, and see if what you've done has improved it too. That's where I'm at this year in my garden is what I've done, has it helped it? Because I've very... high in nitrogen.
Julie, what have you done? I know what you've been doing. You've got some new input. What is it?
Oh, just that I have to have another soil test this year because my nitrogen was so high, and I guess I just over-amended for years and years and years and years. And he said, don't you put anything else on your soil till we do another test.
Well, yes, but you are putting something on all the time right now because it's coming out of one of your houses.
A lot of manure.
And it's not just any manure.
It's the good rabbit stuff.
She's a rabbit manure.
But I promised him no rabbit manure until we figure out how I can reduce it. And it's because my plants would be so big and green and beautiful, but not produce. They were very slow to produce, and I knew something was up, so we're working on it.
Yeah, that's kind of the classic situation of too much nitrogen, where you just get a lot of vegetative growth, but it never goes to the next.
Where's the bean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's a great place to use the soil test and see what you've done.
Yes.
And one of the things that I mentioned in our orchard classes is that if you're curious about your soil and maybe you're not ready to do a soil test, when I'm looking at fruit trees, I'm looking at how much new growth was put on last year. With our bearing trees that we're expecting to produce fruit, we want tip growth to be in that like 8 to 16 inch range. So if you're seeing way more growth than that at your tips on your producing trees, you probably have too much nitrogen. And on our young trees, like that we're not expecting fruit off of yet, we're hoping to get like 24 inches of growth at our tips. And if you're only getting 8 inches of growth on these non-productive trees, then you probably need to boost that nitrogen up.
Wow, you can really see it in your trees.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great way to have some idea. Good.
So let's just talk about cover crops real quick, because I know, Kyle, you have white clover in your orchard.
Yeah, we've used a bunch of different mixes. Usually it is a mix of different species of legumes and maybe some grasses in there as well. The clovers tend to work well for us. They're competitive to where they'll choke out some other species as well.
Good. And deep roots.
Yeah.
Clover has deep
roots. And the clover is being a legume. It's going to fix nitrogen, which is good for your soil as well.
Right. And feed pollinators. So many good things about the cover crops.
Definitely.
And that's what keeping the top of the soil covered is all about, is keeping something on there, even if it's growing or even if it's not growing, you got the compost on there.
And then, Kyle, is that your entire cover around your orchard? It's just the pea gravel and then the white clover?
It's been a mix of different clover species. So I think right now we have one that's a white clover, some red clover, a yellow clover, and some hairy vetch.
Mm-hmm.
After dealing with the vetch for years, I wouldn't recommend putting that in unless you want to be tripping over it all the time. But it is another good nitrogen fixer for us. That's worked well. We've also tried some others. There's something called the subterranean clover, which actually sets its first seed head below ground. So it's supposed to be self-seeding. Unfortunately, when we did our trials with that, it was a extremely dry spring. So we had very poor germination. And it was a fairly expensive seed, so we haven't delved back into that yet. But definitely something that we're thinking about.
And do you have to mow it, or does it just reach a height you're happy with?
So it depends on the clover species. We, in the orchard, we like to have a nice low ground cover, just because the rodents really appreciate it when you have a thick ground cover that they can hide in. So keeping your ground cover low is helpful.
Yeah.
So you've got to do some mowing.
Yeah, definitely. And some species like the Dutch white clover is usually only going to get in that 8 to 10 inch range, where like a medium red clover is going to get 2 or 3 feet tall. So
it's about a lot taller.
Yeah, it's about thinking about your species as well as you're developing your cover crop.
And all clovers is what you prefer.
It doesn't have to be all clovers, but we do like our legumes, our nitrogen fixers. So it's definitely good to have a few of those in the mix, even if you're doing some grasses in there as well.
Okay. Anything else about soils you'd like to add, Kendall? Or we're going to move on to pest control and disease control. So
I could just add a few things about cover crops.
Good.
Please. In that they are a really great and important tool in any kind of organic or regenerative type system, not in an orchard like Kyle was describing, but also in a vegetable system. And I've been working with Kyle and the vegetable market garden program at SOAC to integrate some cover crops and some research into that part of the farm as well. Last summer, we planted a bunch of different types of cover crops to see what grows well up here. It was a very dry spring, so also it was a challenging year to do some cover crop work, but we'll keep working at it.
Yeah, good.
So
my favorite is buckwheat.
That's a good one.
Yes, oh, yeah. I love buckwheat.
Pollinators love it.
Yeah, it grows all summer long. I can pull it if it's in the wrong place and leave it if it isn't, and that's just great.
It's an easy one.
It is an easy one.
In the vegetable setting, of course, you probably have to remove the clover, I'm assuming, but in your orchard, can it just stay and not have to be tilled?
Mm-hmm. Yep, orchard, it's doing its thing out there for sure.
Yeah.
Year after year.
Yeah.
Finally, let's talk about pest and disease ID and controls. When will you spray your, have you sprayed a dormant oil already this winter, Kyle?
Not yet. Okay. So we'll always, we like to save our dormant oil for right after we're done pruning.
Okay.
Just so we're not dealing with oily limbs out there as we're going through and doing our pruning. But yeah, that's the first thing that we do as soon as we're done with our pruning, for sure.
And that's?
So we use a neem oil.
Okay.
You can get neem oil locally, and it's usually a formulation of like 70% neem and 30% paraffin wax or something. It's a lighter weight oil, where 100% neem can be a heavyweight oil and can be difficult to work with. So you need to make sure that your oil is warmed up a bit and you have warm water in your sprayer. And I always recommend doing a thorough hot water wash after you're done spraying.
Yes.
So it doesn't gum up your sprayer, because it can do that in a hurry for sure.
I like the idea of mixing it with warm water. That makes a lot of sense, because cold oil is a bummer.
Yeah, for sure.
Are you still going to put your spraying schedule, your all summer long spraying schedule, on the website?
So we usually do some posts on our Facebook page,
okay.
But we're going to try and get some stuff up on the extension page as well, so it's easily accessible.
Okay. And so we're talking about the cover crops, that's the biological till.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going down in the soil and breaking it up and making things available to the plant.
Exactly.
Very good. We learned some things today, Julie.
Some really good things.
So, this is Julie Perchinsky. I'm here with Garden Life. I have Kyle Nagy, Superintendent and Orchard Operations Manager at the U of I Organic Agriculture Center, and Kendall Call, Assistant Professor and Extension Specialist at the U of I. What else is going on out there at the SOAC Center?
I guess one of our big initiatives that we're working on right now is a collaboration with the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho. So the Kootenai Tribe has been great to work with. They were awarded an EPA Swiffer grant, which has a focus on removing food waste from our solid waste stream. We've been working on that with them for over a year now. And just last fall, we had a new compost system installed at our station up in Sandpoint here. And what it is it's called an earth flow system. And it's a 20-foot shipping container that's been converted into an automated composter. So it has positive aeration. It has a vertical auger that mixes it and everything. Being with a focus on food waste, we're starting to work with some of our local food waste producers. So business we've been working with is Schweitzer Mountain Resort, and they've been bringing food waste down for us. And then we're also getting our carbon source from the Stimson Mill over in Priest River. So trying to make use of some of our local resources here. At first, we're just going to be using this compost on our site as we develop our recipes and test everything out. But eventually, we're hoping to be able to have a local source of compost for our community here. When our compost system is up and running 24/7, 365, we should be producing up to around 200 tons of compost a year. So when we do have that ability, it's something that we want to be able to put out in the community here.
Neat.
Very exciting.
And that container, it's not like a semi-trailer or something like that. What does that container look like?
It's a 20-foot shipping container. So ones that are on the big boats coming across mm-hmm. the ocean, it's a 20-footer mm-hmm. like that. But it's been all converted for this specific use. It's pretty amazing system, really.
And could be replicated everywhere.
Exactly. And that's one of the parts of this initiative with the Kootenai Tribe, is we wanted it to be kind of a pilot program so that other communities can see what we're doing and of our scale for this size of community, and be able to replicate that all over the country.
For sure.
Great.
And is the tribe hoping that they might have one of them on their own property at some point?
So I think they're looking at maybe something smaller to service just the tribe up there. But but we're also working with the casino up there to bring them into the program and start utilizing some of their food waste as well. Our number one thing though is we really need clean waste stream coming in, because mm-hmm. if we're picking plastic mm-hmm. out, it really kills the whole operation. Mm-hmm. So there's a big part of it that goes into the training of this back of kitchen staff, so that they know what can actually be composted.
Sure. And does the compostable material include meat, veggies, breads, everything? Is it just everything that comes out of the restaurant?
Yeah. Yep. We're making sure that they're taking all the labels and everything like that off. Mm-hmm. We're not doing the compostable silverware, like the compostable plastic silverware and stuff at this time. But it's something that this system may be able to fully compost in the future. So, we're looking at all kinds of neat stuff here.
Gosh, always something going on out there. That's exciting.
Yeah.
And Kendall, what are you working on right now?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty excited about having this compost facility and getting to test it as a product. And we'll probably do some field trials using it, as well as some other composting methods that we have infrastructure for at the farm. So we'll also be doing hopefully some side-by-side comparisons with vermicompost, so worm-digested compost.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. I'll be continuing some of the cover crop work this summer, integrating it into sort of the food production that we've got going on in conjunction with the food pantry. And those are sort of, and then we've been doing some monitoring in the sheep and chicken grazing paddocks that Kyle's established several years ago. So trying to understand how those animals impact the weed ecology and sort of, different weed invasions in the pasture.
Gosh, so much going on out there. It's just so great. Kyle, give us your contact information and any pertinent details there.
Yeah, so we're here as a resource. So if anybody has any questions about their fruit trees, feel free to reach out. My email is knagy@uidaho.edu, and my phone number is 208-304-7815. Feel free to reach out with any questions.
Great. And Kendall?
Yes, similarly, I'm happy to talk to folks about their soils or other production interests. And you can reach me at kkahl@uidaho.edu or at 208-885-7505.
And you can go on the webpage, too, and find information about both you guys. So,
for sure.
Well, thank you so much, Julie.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if here as we come into March, if there are going to be any opportunities for folks to come to anything public, or is it pretty much just you guys for a while?
I think right now, mostly what we have going on are our extension classes that we host out at the Ag Center through the extension office that's near the fairgrounds. So if you get signed up for any of the classes mm-hmm. over there, you most likely you'll be having the class out at our station.
Nice.
One other thing that I did want to mention, and it might disappoint a few people, is that we are going to be ending our U-Pick raspberry this year.
Oh.
So our raspberries have been in the ground for more than 8 years, and they're starting to decline in productivity. So we're going to be removing those out of the orchard this year. And we're going to actually be replacing those with some new apple tree varieties. We've been working with the Lost Orchard Project
yes.
out of Eastern Washington. Mm-hmm. And they have graced us with some of the Scion wood from some of these rediscovered varieties. So we're going to be planting some of those out in the orchard this year, which we're excited about.
Cool. And is that David Benscoter's work?
Yeah, David Benscoter. He's such a great person to have in this area.
That's cool. He's so well educated and such an adventurer in that area.
For sure. Yeah, definitely. And as a former FBI investigator, yes, he knows how to find
that's right.
all the details about everything.
So we'll have to try to get him again this year,
yes,
Julie.
He's great. I think there's something happening at the library. next Saturday with the apple?
Yeah, I believe it's next Saturday. Yes. He's having an event out at the Bonner County Library here.
Yes.
So neat. And Kendall, I think you had one thing to mention.
Yeah, we had our first farm and research tour at the SOAC last summer, and we'll probably be looking to do that again this summer. So keep your eyes open for that.
Good. Yeah, good.
Cool. Well, Julie, this hour has gone so fast.
Yes, it has.
We're really just about out of time here.
Okay, okay. Well, I guess we wrap it up. Thank you so much, Kendall Call and Kyle Nagy, for coming in and talking about our summer that's coming in.
Coming in pretty fast. Soon.
Yeah. Coming in fast and hard. Not too fast, I hope.
Yes. All right. Thanks, everybody.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.